I'm sorry. Sorry to disturb you. Don't forget whatever you were saying. Okay, so, all right, so I hope you all feel refreshed, ready to talk about yourself. Because I'm going to just say now a few words about variants, which are the obviously important to us. And also sort of turn out to be an interesting and useful cosmological tool of understanding variants better. And so again, to just show another one of these plots, is that if you change the number of variants you have, then things really change a lot. Again, we saw this plot already, so I'm not going to belabor it. But the point being that you do see the effect of variants in cosmology, in the cosmology. And so measuring the amount of variants we have and having various ways of doing that is actually a very good thing to be able to do. Not just out of any sort of narcissistic interest in the kind of matter we're made out of. And so the way that you do that, this is sort of a thing that's under active study by people other than me, is by looking at something called baryon acoustic oscillations, which you can see in the power spectrum from galaxies. And so basically the way that baryon acoustic oscillations form is as follows. This is, again, related to what Joao was saying. But I'm going to take it a step further, because I'm going to go on after the CMB was made. Actually, Bob Nichols is going to go on, but I'm going to talk about it using his slides. So this is actually triply removed, because Martin White made these figures, and then Bob Nichols made the slides, and then I'm showing them to you. So. It's good to give citations. Anyway, so you take these initial expanding wave of baryons and photons, and they're tightly coupled, as you've been hearing about. And so that means that this line, these two lines sit together, there's like a pink line and a blue line. And one represents the photons and one represents the baryons. And they're right on top of each other. Oh, and since there's no axis here, I should say, this is like some kind of density contrast. And this is some kind of radius. And so we're taking the simplest possible picture, which is just an expanding wave. It started at the middle and has been expanding outward. So that you have a real shell, because it's been just expanding in three dimensions. Out. And so there's a well-defined shell out here, and there's a void inside, and this has nothing to do with the real universe, because the real universe isn't like this. But it does give you a very simple view of how the physics works. And so what's important is that so you have some shell expanding like this, back in tight coupling, and it's everything's hunky dory, then decoupling happens, it's kind of like divorce, it's split up. And suddenly the photons keep on freely streaming, because that's what photons love to do whenever they're not tightly coupled to plasma. But the baryons suddenly don't feel any pressure at all. The photons aren't pushing them. And so they just get to just hang out and be baryons and try to figure out what to do with themselves. Fortunately, gravity comes in, home record that it is, and pulls some of those baryons back towards the center of the shell because of gravity, which you've been hearing about. And so then the photons are all spread out by now, but the baryons aren't. And so but you retain a memory in basically your density profile for baryons of how far you went with the photons before you broke up. And so that bump is in some sense the baryon acoustic oscillation that gives you some memory of what happened in the early universe. And it's a distinctively baryonic effect, because baryons used to be coupled to photons, but then they aren't. So you can never see that in dark matter, but you can see it in baryons. But since, as I was saying, the like simple expanding shells don't really exist except for whenever you detonate nuclear weapons. You have to do this statistically, and you can basically the universe looks a lot like a, even though it doesn't look much like a single expanding shell, it looks like billions of overlapping expanding shells, pretty good. And so you can just, if you look statistically, you should see basically the same kind of bump, only in a statistical way. And, or B, you sure do. You look at a bunch of the luminous red galaxies from SDSS, as Dan Eisenstein did, then you see exactly the bump. And you can see exactly where there's still a residual memory in the very way that galaxies are clumped today, in the fact that the baryons that make up galaxies like us was carried along by photons way back in the pre-decoupling era. So I think that's pretty cool. It's pretty amazing that they were able to measure it, too. So I just want to pause and admire that great feat of physics right there. Anyway, it's very cool. And it turns out you can use it for all kinds of stuff. Because, and this is just a quick slide that I only partially understand about why this is actually useful for cosmology. And basically because the location of that bump, again, anytime whenever you have locations and relative sizes at distances far away from you, that's a good thing in cosmology. It allows you to measure things about the history of the universe. And so basically if you guess the wrong cosmology, this is the point of this slide, and that the real so cosmology is really a cosmological constant with omega matter equals 0.3, but then you did a model where, you know, you had your quintessence model, Joe Bob's quintessence model, and it actually had the equation of state with W equals minus 0.9, then you get a variation from the real model, which is a straight line, that looks like this as a function of redshift. Like where this is where the dotted line is a density contrast. And so basically you're going to be able to see by looking at the location of that acoustic peak, that baryon acoustic wiggle, something about whether this is really the right cosmology or whether this is. How you actually do that in practice, I'm not quite sure. But I'm very confident that Blake Glassbrook and Tom Hanks do know how. And so you should know as well that somebody also knows how to do that. Because it is relevant. And it provides yet another way of measuring these. And just to say as an aside of it, there are times, in fact, in the last couple of years where they've had fairly strong disagreements between these measurements and measurements in another way. I think they've all been resolved now, but it's not necessarily true that they had to be resolved. I mean, you can do a measurement like this and find something different and then find a mistake. Or a problem, not a mistake necessarily, but a problem in your cosmological model. And that's interesting. All of us are young. We don't have faculty jobs yet. We all want there to be problems in the current model because that gives us things to do and subsequently have careers, right? Anyway, so I talked about how other people have used this data up till now. And I'm going to give you a little, like, a sample idea of why you should have been listening for the last hour if you weren't. About how you yourself might go about using these data whenever you're doing your thesis or other research projects. And I'm saying this because the reason I know enough about this to give even the sketchy talk is because when I was a graduate student, much like you, just a couple of years ago, my advisor gave me a stack of papers and said, learn about the Sloan Digital Sky Survey because I need you to use it to analyze something. And so, I had to sort of try it by fire, run it by myself. And so basically, there's two ways that you can use the data. One is that if you have a new model, not inflation, for how the primordial power factor comes out, or if you have a new addition to the standard inflationary model, and you want to, and it's going to change the primordial power factor in some way. Now, the impression that you will get from listening to talks, to introductory talks, introductory books on cosmology, is that inflation is the be-all and end-all, and that their scalar field had these quantum mechanical fluctuations, and they made everything, and you know it's very good. And that's, although somewhat true, I guarantee you that everybody you know who's a theoretical physicist has, at some point or another, tried to add something to inflation, either by changing the nature of the scalar field, or by making the scalar field do funny things, or like, or you're going to hear about from, or I'm sure you've been hearing from Liam about like putting it in the brain world or something. And lots of times whenever you start doing that, whenever you start dressing up your inflation model to make it look nice to you and to put your name on so that you get hired, that you do things that change the primordial power factor to not be the simple thing that you can calculate on the blackboard like Will Kinney does so beautifully, but something a little bit different. And so, after you've done that, though, since inflation fits the data so well, then you're going to have to go back to these data and say, well, you know, I know that I'm changing the primary power spectrum in X, Y, and Z way, but I can fit the data just as well as inflation, which is sort of the first acid test that any new theory you have has to pass. before anyone will even begin to take it seriously. You can have later theoretical arguments about whether it's motivated to change things, but you darn well better fit the data at least as well as inflation. And so in practice, because it's the simplest parameter that measures the primordial power spectrum, this usually means comparing what your new model does to the spectral index compared with what some standard inflationary model will do with the spectral index. Okay, so that's one thing that you're going to see talks about in your life. The other thing that you can use it for is there's a whole lot of cosmology that happens since the primordial power spectrum. You heard again a lot about this from Pat McDonald, who's a real expert on it. But lots of times you're going to have a model that's going to predict something new. It's going to predict a big neutrino mass. In fact, just a month ago, an anxious person who works here, who will remain nameless, came to talk to me because his model was predicting neutrino masses that were higher than those allowed by the Lyman-Alpha force. And he wanted me to tell him that the Lyman-Alpha force was evil and not trustworthy, and if his model was better. And that's not actually what he asked. He just wanted to know if his model was already excluded or if it was okay. And then another very eminent physicist, who I will also not name, wanted to also know about the Lyman-Alpha force, if you trust it, because he had some other thing that disagreed with it. So there's lots of these theories that you come up with, and you never know. It could make a prediction on anything on that long list of parameters that I bored you with earlier. And if you don't match with that, then you better know how to either get around it, that not matching, or you can learn yourself how to analyze the data, and you can try to analyze it again to see if, by completely reanalyzing the data, you can make your model fit. Because remember, I was trying to emphasize that all of these parameters that fit have been assuming the model. And you can't, if you change the model, then you can't just plug in the old parameters into your new model and see if it works out. But in fact, what you really have to do is like go back and you know, find the ways in which all those lines tilt and everything move in your model, and see that your new model also makes a prediction that matches what's actually observed in the real universe. And theorists have a very, very bad habit of just, you know, coming up with a model that has very little to do with the old model, trying to find a new parameter in their model that looks a lot like the old parameter in the old model, and then seeing whether they agree. And that can work, but you have to be very careful, because that's not really honest. Well, it's honest, but it's not necessarily the best thing to do, because you might find that your model can work better if you do the analysis yourself. Anyway, but I'm going to tell you about why the thing I did with these data in my own life. This will be not this slide, but the next one will be the only thing in this entire talk that's actually original to me. And that's for constraining cosmic strings. Now, cosmic strings I'm not going to tell you much about, but they are a completely theoretical, but in some people's minds, well-motivated object that emerges from phase transitions in the early universe. Basically, if you have a phase transition in the early universe that has a cylindrical symmetry that allows the old field. So if you have something like a Higgs potential for a scalar field or for some field where you have a, you know what the Higgs field potential looks like. You know, like a Mexican hat where the field has a degeneracy direction that has a circle in it. Anyway, if that exists in your model of the universe, then there could be points in the universe, or actually not points, but lines in the universe where the field is stuck at the local minimum, because basically the field configuration is such that you can't locally smoothly deform from, say, the field value being over here and the degenerate field value on the other side in that point. This is a long story. But the point is that those things are very high energy things that actually perturb the plasma in the early universe in a significant way. And it was of interest to people that to constrain how much perturbation they could have to be primordial power. So this falls under the first part that I was talking about. It's like you want to make an addition to the primordial power spectrum, and you want to find out what it does to the data. And so what you can do is just basically take the inflationary line, which we all know and love, And then this is the this power spectrum, you see this dark one here? This is more or less the one that comes from cosmic strings. Obviously, it doesn't work by itself. It's a desperate, horrible failure for predicting all of that, that structure. So the question you can ask is, so if I take the inflationary line and then I add a little bit of this line, can I still match up to all of those data? And then there's this group who did a paper recently, whenever they were doing this, with they have a much fancier model for how to get this dark line than I did whenever I did this project a couple of years ago. Anyway, and but they just used WMAP, and they found a result, even though their dark line was very similar to the dark line that I used, or that our collaboration used to add this in, they found this limit on the cosmic string tension GNU. You don't have to know anything about this. All you have to know is that they used only WMAP, even though they used this model that was sort of similar, and they found about a limit of 7 times mu minus it. However, in contrast, whenever we did this, we also included the Sloan Digital Sky Survey data. And basically doing exactly the same thing, only including Sloan, we found a limit that was 2 times 10 to the minus 7. And I'm not saying this to denigrate what they did. They were completely honest and upfront about it. In their model, it was hard for them to predict fluctuations on the scale, so they couldn't really directly compare. But the point is that your model, whenever you predict the primordial power, and you compare it to WMAP, which is what you're going to want to do, you might not get the right answer. You might actually be more constrained than you think you are, because the galaxies are there. And so this is a real-life example. There's a whole lot more subtlety than I'm glossing over. But the point here is that you can't just ignore the power spectrum from galaxies. It actually adds constraints.
Excuse me.
Yes?
Well, you have one of the simpler magnitudes, right?
Yeah. I mean, right, no. But if someone said, I'm going to pay you $10,000, and then they said, no, I'm going to pay you $2,000, it's still the same order of magnitude.
Yeah, but in cosmology, I mean, these numbers don't matter so much.
Yeah, well, I can put it this, though. I mean, I know it seems like not so much, but it really, I mean, a factor of five, 4 or 5, That's a real difference, and that's all I'm saying. Is that whenever we're in the era of precision cosmology, as people like to say, and it's relevant to start realizing that by adding more, but we have experiments you can trust that give us real, honest to goodness, better measurements of things. And it's important to remember that you have to take that into account, because even though this one doesn't really bother anybody, like this difference, but if you have a model where you have the neutrino is really not a neutrino, but it's a low energy excitation of a scalar field with a spinner degree of freedom. And that your neutrino has to have a mass of 6 electron volts, or else your model falls apart. And it's measured, and you find out that the neutrino mass can't be higher than 2 electron volts. You know, it's only a factor of 3, but your model completely will matter. So it will matter very much to you whether that factor of 3 is true or not. Does that make sense? So that's all I'm saying. Is that you can get these factors of 3. You can actually do this in cosmology now. You can be accurate to factors of 2 and 3. And that means that we can actually start constraining models. But to do that, we have to take the data seriously. That's all my point. But to continue in the vein of like of saying this is hard, and that unlike the CMB, galaxies involve lots of gravity, I just want to, and to continue on this other point, that you're going to want these constraints to go away. That you can run, but you can't hide. And that even if you have a model that matches the WMAP but not the galaxies, and you just leave the galaxies out conveniently in your paper, and your competitor is not going to, and they're going to go in and show that, well, you know, Johnson et al. Found this great agreement with WMAP, but we read analyzer data, including Sloan, and we find that their data is excluded at 3 sigma. And you'll be a laughing stock, and you'll have wasted your time. And so what's important for you to understand, even if you don't do anything that's even very closely related to cosmology, that there are like all kinds of constraints coming here. And it's important to have some sense in how much you can trust them. Most of the ones I've talked about so far are pretty trustworthy. The ones, when you get into the realm of some of these, like the neutrino masses, and not just the value of the spectral effects, but whether it's running or changing with scale, then you get into controversial territory. Now, So let me just tell you why you can, how you can go wrong. You heard about from Joelle about this, the phenomenon of some systematic effects that where they found all of these mistakes, basically in the first year of WMAP data, that were systematic errors. What does that mean? It's basically where you have physics going on, actual physical processes that really happen in the real world that are consistently changing your answer in a way that you don't account for. And so you get a consistent answer that's not right. It's consistently off by some factor. And so different things that can come in are something that some people like to call gastrophysics, which is like not just the feeling you get whenever you've eaten bad Mexican food, but it's just sort of all the physics that happens in gas clouds and whenever like shocks form and nonlinear processes happen. And this actually influences things in like galaxies and in gas clouds, like the Lyman-Alpha clouds. But these are not perfect fluids. They're not simple perfect fluids where there's a bunch of little balls bouncing off each other. But crazy stuff happens. And we can understand that to some extent. But turbulence is real. And shocks are real. And you have to really, you want to understand how well you can actually trust all of your knowledge of all of this detailed physics. It's not just linear growing modes that you one day turn into a galaxy. Lots of complicated things have happened. And this again, so this is basically the same line, it's just nonlinear effects. You have to, and any star in any galaxy that you find has already undergone a very dramatic collapse of them. And it's aged and gone through a lot of processing before it started the making of the light that lets us see it. So you can't get away from this, except for by just looking at the CMB. And so then you also have experimental, possible just actual errors in your experiment. So I just want to show a quick movie about this. It's actually, this isn't actually really long, but I'm just going to show part of it. This is, again, experiment, numerical data. So this is taking a gas cloud that's a proto-galactic cloud at Z of 20 and running it forward. And so basically, I want you to see, this is the dark matter you see. This is what cosmologists wish that we could see directly. But what we see directly is something that has to do more with gas shocks and gas temperature over here. So these are the shocks that slow matter down enough for it to clump up on small scales and make stars and things like us. And the point is that you see all of this activity happening here at Z equals 2. Long before a Sloan Digital Sky Survey sees anything. Now this is all screwing you up. There's all kinds of hot stuff going on here. This is not linear, this is bad. And this is happening over a big old link scale. This is a cluster of galaxies. And there's a big old hot gas everywhere. And it's messing, and it's going to be complicated to understand what's happening here. And this is not to say, this is not to make you all lose your faith in the ability of cosmology to predict anything, but just to remind you that yeah, there's a lot that goes into understanding what happens there, and it's not just a simple thing. Anyway, it's also really pretty. Okay, I'm just going to stop that there. And there's one other thing that people do a lot, and that's a combined experiment. Now, I was just talking about how, in my own work, I combined the WMAP experiment with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey experiment, and that was, we thought, a very good thing to do. And the great thing about doing that, as I was trying to emphasize why you should pay attention to my talk at all, given that WMAP has measured everything, is that you can get different errors from different kinds of experiments, from different kinds of measurements, that hopefully will be uncorrelated with the errors that you get from the first experiment. So, I mean, what if the WMAP team, you know, somebody accidentally dropped his, keys into the satellite right before it went off. And it consistently sort of made the satellite yaw in some particular way. And then nothing else went wrong. But for some reason, this heated up the instrument in a funny way, and so you find Joao's axis of evil because of somebody's keys in the satellite. And you'll never find out, because you're never going to see that satellite again, why you have this funny effect. But that's why you have to do another experiment later to find out, you know, make sure it's not just something about them or something they've done, that you have other different physics that you can look at the same effect, the same scales with, preferably, and produce these systematic errors or correct for them by finding, because every experiment is going to have systematic errors. So it's just have compensatory ones, and hopefully they're not going to all be the same systematic error in all the different experiments. But the bad thing that can happen is that you can over-measure parameters. If you start adding lots of data, that if, even if you have, you know, if you have, you know, you have some kind of plot here, and you start, and you have data points, and they all have these huge error bars, and you know, and you sort of look at this and you say, oh, you know, you can't measure anything with error bars like that. But if you start to add up a whole bunch of points, all with bad error bars, the way that statistics works is that you're going to start to make a stronger and stronger statistical measurement if all of those lines overlap. And even though you're not really making a that much better of a measurement of the real physics behind it. And so you can kind of over-constrain things by over-measuring parameters by putting in too much sort of data that hasn't been properly sort of decorrelated. Like if you just, you know, take the same data point and measure it with 50 different identical experiments, it'll seem like you have 50 different data points, but it's not really true. And so obviously this is complicated stuff. I'm not going to give you a course in that. But it's just something that is important to remember. And the Lyapunov and Alpha course is actually a really good example of this, of all the stuff that I've been talking about, and how people have really tried to rise to the occasion and like account for all of these difficulties, but the results of which remain controversial, hence like the friends of mine I was telling you about who don't want to believe the results. And the reason why is basically, I just pulled these slides from Pat's talk, is that basically if you look at sort of like the Lyman alpha stuff, which is the blue line and the green lines, and then the WMAP and WMAP and SDSS main galaxies. There's a disconnect here, right? You have all of the stuff from Lyman alpha. I mean, I can't even remember what these parameters are. But the point is, there's these the peaks of these different ellipses are not in the same spot, right? And so this is going to start to give you a little bit of an anxiety attack if you think that they should be in the same spot. And it may be that it's completely well-motivated and true, and you've learned something, but it also makes some people worry. So exactly because so much complicated physics has gone into something like the Lyman-Alpha interpretation. And so in particular, just to go back to Buchanan and see it, I'm sorry. So anyway, so the things that really got changed a lot by adding Lyman-Alpha were this clumpiness detector, sigma 8. This is actually a relevant one because this is an outstanding problem in physics. Is that you measure sigma 8 using all of these different data. You can't see it here, but it's 0.85 plus errors. And then there's another way to measure sigma 8 directly in the cosmic microwave background radiation. It's basically that in the CMB you have all these peaks, right, which you've seen a lot. It turns out that because there are clusters of galaxies with hot gas in them between us and the CMB, there's something called the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect happens. And basically, those clusters of galaxies appear at angular scales around here, and they're going to generate power in the cosmic microwave background radiation at a characteristic scale like this. And if you can measure that directly, you can get a measurement, and it turns out, of this parameter sigma 8. And this has been measured by one experiment called the CBI experiment. So they have a single measurement of this, which gives some measure of sigma 8. But that measure of sigma 8 that they get disagrees pretty radically with this one. And so right now that's unresolved. A lot of people think that the CBI measurement is flawed in some way. But it's relevant to say that whenever you start combining experiments like this, you can, in fact, find these discrepancies. And it may be that they're nothing and they'll go away. It may be that something else is happening. And then again, other things that the Lyman alpha found is like this running of the spectral index that a lot of people don't, have trouble with, and again, this neutrino mass thing. But all of these different measurements come down to one fact about the Lyman alpha forest. You see, all of their points are out here, and they're not corrected by any other points. There's nothing that overlaps the Lyman alpha forest in these scales. You see that? And so basically, that if you wanted to make all of my friends happy and have heavier neutrinos and no running spectral index, then what you would do is you would just have a little bit less power on those scales. And if you just consistently take all of the Lyman alpha lines and you can find some systematic error that they're missing, and it's tilted like this. You change all of those, all three of those results would be changed. Because they all have to do with the clumping on these scales, where the Lyman albiflorus is the only game in town. Now, I'm not saying they're doing it wrong. They could, they're very likely doing everything right. They've thought about this for years. But I just want to say that even though it seems like three very disparate phenomena, the clumping of gas on a particular scale, the mass of neutrinos, and the shape of the primordial particle, all of those three very disparate parameters are all being measured in this way because of the slope of this length way up here, more or less. And there's more that goes into it than that. And I just wanted to point out to you that if they found some reason why the Lyman albiflorus systematically was being overestimated in this way, all of those parameters would change. And so, the members of the team are very aware of this, and so they do try to take it. I don't want to give you the wrong impression. But just, it's good to know that these things happen. This is more or less what I was just saying. But the other thing to take away from that is whenever you only have one very hard to estimate thing like the Lyman albiflorus that's eliminating your model, you can get nervous, but you don't necessarily have to throw your model away. And also, something like if you have a running of a spectral engine, if you don't have any good motivation for why it should be true in your theoretical model, but then you find a sort of a statistical argument for it, it doesn't necessarily mean that you need to take it. It's like, that's interesting. I don't believe it though. And that's okay. If you pare down parameters and make the foot a little bit worse, but you don't have any reason for including that parameter, sometimes it's all right. Because sometimes it's just, there's something you don't understand. And so it should always fight the impulse to add unnecessary parameters. Unless they're ones that you particularly like. Okay, so but just to close out the last couple of minutes, I just want to say that, as I said right at the beginning, though I don't really have much to say about it, there's also a lot of astrophysics here, that galaxies and quasars are interesting in their own right, and surveys of galaxies, which Sloan is not the last one. There's going to be even bigger ones, bigger, better ones on the way. And in addition to counting up and correlating these galaxies to give us a power spectrum, they actually just look at the galaxies by themselves and tell you all kinds of statistics about what galaxies are like. Because if you have 500,000 galaxies, you have a catalog of what that galaxy looked like. I mean, Messier was famous and he only had a couple hundred. And also that because if you have a huge survey where you look at hundreds of thousands of things and you start finding rare things, and rare things are always interesting to physicists, right? Because it's our chance of finding something we didn't expect. So two simple examples in Sloan that they find with some regularity are gravitational lensing events and very distant quasars. I mean, gravitational lensing is kind of cool because it sort of lets you see a dark matter halo, basically. Is that if you see a double lensing event or a triple lensing, something like that, you can actually see the gravitational effect of dark matter, even though you aren't seeing it directly. That's kind of cool. And then very, very distant quasars, you can sort of have some sense about when the earliest structures form. Because if you find a quasar that was at a redshift of 20, you're not going to do it. But if you did, you have to rewrite your history of the universe, because right now we don't have any way of making a quasar that early. And so it's relevant to know like how old the oldest quasar is. But as far as I can tell, having been in an astronomy department, it's sort of like the sort of brain racing, so we have the oldest quasar. They always have, and so this is at some point in the last few years, this was the oldest and most distant quasar that had ever been found. It was from Sloan. And you can tell it's old because it's red. And so there it is. Redshift is 6.4. Really remarkable. Nothing really to say about that. And here are a bunch of gravitational lensing events that Sloan was just reporting. This is just on the archive last week. It's relevant. It's hard to find gravitational lensing events because they're rare. But here they are. There's four of them, as you can tell. These are quasars. Which these are two pictures of the same quasar right next to each other. I was going to talk about statistics, but I'm kind of tired, and I don't really think that this room looks like it's ready for more. So I'm going to stop there. Thank you very much.